I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
Americans are choosing their next leader, the highest voter turnout in a century.
We have it within us to actually transform and deliver a different kind of future for our country.
Whether Trump is president or not, we're going to have to reckon with Trumpism for a very long time.
To stop the vote suggests to stop the very democracy that we are running and these persons are running to uphold.
The country's been playing politics for a long time on this hatred. We know this.
I hate that I have to say I belong. Why do I have to justify that I'm American?
Working class people, black people, indigenous people, brown people, immigrants deserve to have their votes counted.
Thus far, just shy of 150 million votes have been counted. That's as of now, a day after every major news organization concluded that Joe Biden won. That means more people voted in this presidential election than ever before. Joe Biden has declared victory and claimed a mandate. He's got a point. 75 million people and counting said they want him to be president, which is, it's notable, 9 million more people than voted for Barack Obama in 2008. Biden's also well on his way to 300 Electoral College votes. So by traditional standards of electoral politics, he can certainly reasonably claim a mandate. But of course, whenever we ask this question, does the winner have a, quote, mandate? What we really mean is, do we agree on the next steps? Have we resolved anything? And that I do not know the answer to. This show, The United States of Anxiety, was born in reaction to Donald Trump's 2016 campaign. And as I said in almost every episode of that season of our show, the ideas and sentiments that Donald Trump represented would remain with us no matter what happened in that election. And so indeed, 4 years later, at least 71 million people are still willing to vote in support of those ideas and sentiments. So for those of us who find the racism and the sexism and the authoritarian elements of Trump's politics repugnant, what now? The past 4 years have been deeply alienating for so many people, black people, immigrant families, Muslim Americans, women, transgender people. Honestly, even just living in a big city has meant that you and your community have probably been insulted at some point. And I just wonder how that experience has changed all of us, or has it changed all of us? I want to know. Call us up and tell me. After all of this, how do you feel about your place in this country? How do you feel about this country in general? Maybe you found yourself newly patriotic, or maybe you've lost a sense of pride you once had. How do you feel about the United States and your place in it? This is just a check-in on that question. Call us up at 646-435-7280. Again, that's 646-435-7280. Or tweet us using the hashtag USofAnxiety. I also wonder about how these past 4 years have changed your own life or your choices in your life. It certainly changed mine. As I said, we launched this show in reaction to Donald Trump's campaign in 2016. Back then, I was a print journalist, so I've ended up with a whole different career as a result of the Trump era. What about you? How has your life changed as a result of the past 4 years? Call us up at 646-435-7280. Again, that's 646-435-7280, or tweet us using the hashtag USofAnxiety. And as we take your calls, I am so thrilled to be joined by my friend and colleague, Melissa Harris-Perry. I imagine many of our listeners were also card-carrying members of Nerdland, as the fans of Melissa's weekend show on MSNBC used to call ourselves. She is a professor of politics and international affairs, as well as a professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Wake Forest University. And Melissa, you have just launched a new podcast called Systems Check, which you co-host with Dorian Warren. Congrats on that. It's a great timing to launch a new political podcast, I think.
Oh, sure. That seems fine that it would be good timing. We did it very swiftly, and I don't think Dorian or I have recovered any sense of balance or rest in the context of how swiftly we decided to do it. But I have enjoyed every moment of it so far, in part because I just really do adore Dorian and have actually been talking politics with him pretty much all day for 20 years.
For many, many years.
Yeah, we figured we'd just let some other folks in on it as well.
Well, I don't think you're going to regain your balance anytime soon. But let me start this conversation by asking you the same questions I've put to our listeners. I mean, has the past 40 years changed you in any meaningful way, or has it not changed you? How would you answer that question?
Oh, Kai, I don't think we want to start with my past 4 years.
Yes, we do.
No.
It's a loaded question because I know some of the answers, but I want to hear it.
No, it's so I do want to back away from the highly personal, because yes, it has been for me what I would call an extraordinarily traumatic 4 years, some of which has been connected to our politics, much of which has not been directly necessarily connected. But I think like anyone who experiences either joy or trauma, there's no way that we can have those experiences without reading them in part through the filter of the larger historic, social, political moment in which we live. And so I can imagine that in times of personal trauma, when the country seems as though it is quite happy and content, it must feel like an awful sense of disconnect to be experiencing personal trauma at the same time that others seem to be prospering. Yeah. My experience was having a lot of personal trauma at the same time that the nation was roiling in trauma. And so many people and communities that I cared so deeply about were also experiencing stunning and painful losses. And I think in that sense, it leads you to try to place your own personal experience within that broader context and to ask how we are all deeply connected in those economic, social, and political ways.
All right. Well, but you also, I mean, your life and work gives you a unique vantage on, you know, something that we've been experiencing together for the last, you know, 3 or 4 days in terms of just the way in which our democracy is mediated by these large for-profit media companies. And it's just been this weird experience to watch, you know, and I'm trying to figure out how to wrap my head around it and the experience. And you've been very vocal about the ways in which the relationship between our politics and our media. And I just kind of want to hear your reflections on the last few days with that.
Sure. So, you know, I certainly, when I left MSNBC just over 4 years ago, part of what initiated that very painful public departure had everything to do with some deep disagreements about the way that cable news was making use of the precious resource that is television airtime. So I'll say, you know, I'm not a journalist. I wasn't trained as a journalist. I'm a political scientist who found myself in 2012 with this kind of shocking and exciting platform, right? A national television show. And I learned a lot of things, but I think the most important thing I learned coming out of the academy and into televised cable news is that the camera is so extraordinarily powerful. I like to say the camera is like love and sunlight and water. It makes things grow, right? So anything you put the camera on will grow. Think of the first reality TV shows like Survivor. And now, right, you put the camera on that and the next thing, you know, you have lots of reality TV shows. You get one Real Housewives, suddenly 20 Real Housewives, right? So I was, and so it taught me I had to be much different in the way that I would, for example, call in a guest. In a classroom, oh, you can put any kind of horrifying idea on the table and you can walk around it and you can think about it. You can pick it up off the table. You can adjudicate it as a class because that's what a classroom is. But with television, you have to be much more careful about the ideas that you give airtime, not because we're censoring, but because we recognize that anything that you put that camera on will grow. So I was sitting there watching cable news make candidate Trump grow. That not that they were bad people or there were folks like sitting around saying, we shall make Trump president, but rather that there were just baked in incentives for us to watch an empty podium with a breaking news banner that said Trump to speak, rather than to even take the other Republican candidates in 2016. And so I guess what I'd say is again, there was a lot that happened in that split, but certainly part of it was my sense that many, even within what was presumably a more progressive media space, were not using our cameras and our television minutes as precious as they are wisely. And then I saw that again in this case where, you know, there came a point where they were going to count the votes, and then there was going to come a point where we were going to call it. And really, no one needed to be held hostage to 24-hour punditry about how to count to 270, because a lot of things were happening. There were a lot of down ballot races. There were fascinating activists to talk to. There was so much that happened in this election that basically didn't get covered because of this impulse to think about the news in a very narrow way. And so I guess what I would say is, I hope that that part of what's happened in the podcast world we find ourselves in, or in the audio world we find ourselves in, is that we provide some kind of alternative diet, and that American viewers maybe don't reward those television minutes that do so little to educate the public on the public's own airwaves.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about tonight. So, you know, media is certainly one of them. Our phones, of course, have already erupted. So I want to start immediately just bringing some folks in. Dan in New Jersey, I understand, Dan, that you feel like you have been changed over the course of the past 4 years. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Yes, thank you for putting me on. Yes, I have been changed. Actually, what I told your screener was not about how personally I've been changed, but that I text with a friend, a college friend down in Florida a lot, she's in Trump, you know, Trump land, and she's a Trump voter. I know she's a, you know, intelligent, caring person, and I don't quite understand a lot about her, but I was asking her about whether she felt the election was stolen, or she felt okay about it. She said, oh, no, don't. She feels it's stolen. And not just that. She says that reaching out, it seems like people are trying to, you know, it's come by out. That's the way she put it. You know, she feels it's patronizing.
It's patronizing to have for Democrats to reach out to her now.
Exactly. She feels like the patron. It's insincere. And it's really all about its power. Okay, and that I really respect what Stacey Abrams did down in Georgia. It really is all about power. If real power is not attained, then if we're depending upon conversations, then those conversations will be rejected. It would be that reaching out would be seen as disingenuous.
Thank you for that, Dan. Melissa, he does kind of get to something I've been thinking about a lot in these last few days. I mean, because there's been so much already debate around, you know, what is the next step for the Democrats and what do they owe the Trump voters and who should they reach out to versus, you know, should we continue to try to persuade Trump voters is one half of the Democratic Party. And the other half is like, no, we got to just have the power and move on. What have you noticed in this conversation and just already in the last 24 hours since Biden won?
So it's, you know, I appreciate the caller so much, in part because, you know, I don't live in New York. I don't live in a big city. I live in North Carolina in kind of a mid-sized city. And in fact, my county, both in 2016 and in 2020, was among the swingiest or the purplest, right, mm-hmm. where truly we all live next door to each other. And I also teach students who are Trump supporters. A few were this year, but certainly in 2016, students who were Trump supporters, as well as those who've supported and voted for Democrats. And so I want to make a couple of distinctions. So one distinction is between voters and elected officials. And, you know, the question of whether or not voters or citizens or residents of a nation ought to be about the business of creating community in ways that allow us to be able to be in community with people with whom we have deep disagreements is quite different than whether or not elected leaders, particularly with very narrow margins, ought to be seeking to make bipartisan deals that actually harm aspects of their party who would otherwise not have any sort of protection. And I think it's really important to make that distinction. So, you know, your caller talks about talking across the line of difference and trying to keep that open, even if you don't quite understand each other. And I think that's really different than whether or not Joe Biden and, you know, Mitt Romney are going to engage in a fix, so-called, to the ACA that actually leaves more Americans without health insurance, right? That is where the issue of power and having power and exercising it is necessary. And then, you know, the piece about like, should we reach out to Trump voters from an electoral perspective, you know, this is why we're doing the work we are on System Check, the new podcast, is when we talk about it that way, it is as though, one, that presidential politics has anything to do with the popular vote, when of course it does not. Well, not that it has nothing to do with it, but very little to do with it, does not translate exactly. And then secondly, that we now have a 2020 census that we have a lot of reason to think may have been compromised with a meaningful undercount, both because of the COVID-19 crisis and because of the rhetoric and practices of the Trump administration. And that 2020 census is now going to state houses that are still largely controlled by Republicans, who are going to have power to again, draw and redraw congressional districts as well as state districts. You can reach out all you want. They're not even in your district. Like, this is, you know, like, this is just a totally separate issue relative to strategy.
And that it's really interesting thinking about the sort of down ballot races in this cycle too, as well. When you look at some of that, when we wonder about the places where Democrats lost, they didn't, where the polling was off. That all may be true, but it's also my question I have is how much of that was about that these districts were drawn to not be lost in the first place. That's how they were drawn 10 years ago.
But yeah, by the way, I gotta say, I don't think the evidence is great that the most progressive wing of the Democratic Party cost centrists their seats, given that so many of those most progressive members did get reelected in their spaces. And again, I think that's really where we need to be looking towards these systems.
Hold that thought, because I want to talk about that at some length. But Stephanie from the West Side, Stephanie, I think, has a question or a comment on this business of the Electoral College and how our democracy is designed. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
So you felt like the Electoral College you wanted to mention is part of the problem?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's sort of for starters. But, you know, the original frame was how are you feeling in this democracy? Uh-huh. And while I'm relieved with millions of other Americans that Biden was elected, I don't particularly regard myself living in a democracy. We call it a democracy, but I really think we need to stop doing that and look at things more objectively. And what I think about specifically is, well, start with the Electoral College. I live in New York. My vote doesn't matter as much as somebody in, you know, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Texas. That's ridiculous. That's not democracy. It's not representative government in the purest form. There's that. Then there's the issue that, you know, I'm in my 50s, early 50s. For the rest of my life, the Supreme Court judges that are nominated in 9 days are going to have huge influence over my life. So yeah. There's one person. What's democratic about that? And lastly, in the midst of climate change and a pandemic, we need science more than ever. It is literally going to save our lives. And there seems to be a majority of people for whom it's some sort of subjective whimsy, which it's sort of an a la carte menu of what they can pick or choose to believe. So no, I don't really feel like I'm living in a democracy.
I'm going to let you go with that, Stephanie. Thank you. So Stephanie says it's not a democracy at all. She doesn't feel any relationship to it. Let's squeeze in one more person before break. Stephen in Pearl River. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Wow. Hi, guys. By the way, it's just a privilege to be on the radio with the notorious MHP. I just wanted to say that.
It's kind of like the notorious RBG. Now you've got a moniker.
Wait. You know, however you want to look at it, but I can tell you this right now that, you know, I may be the unofficial president of our fan club. In the meantime, let's talk about how always looking over my shoulder, waiting for another norm-shattering shoe to drop, whether it was the footnotes added to Mitch McConnell's rules for Supreme Court nominations or assaulting the Affordable Care. all these things. And, you know, while I do have a small sense of relief, it's small. You know, when I look at how many people voted to affirm hatred, racism, intolerance, and cruelty on Tuesday, it's a bit concerning, and it is mind-numbing to me as well. I did not expect that.
Stephen, I've got to take a break, so I'm going to let you go. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright.
I'm proud of the coalition we put together, the broadest and most diverse coalition in history. Democrats, Republicans, independents, progressives, moderates, conservatives, young, old, urban, suburban, rural, gay, straight, transgender, white, Latino, Asian, Native American. I mean it, especially for those moments, and especially for those moments when this campaign was at its lowest ebb. The African-American community stood up again for me. You've always had my back, and I'll have yours.
That was President-elect Joe Biden on Saturday night, having, as he re-accepted his, I'm sorry, not accepted his nomination, as he declared victory in the presidential campaign and declared his mandate and described what he believes to be his coalition. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm with Melissa Harris Perry, professor of politics and gender studies, amongst other things, at Wake Forest University, and co-host of the new podcast Systems Check with Dorian Warren from The Nation magazine. And Melissa, so having heard that clip from Joe Biden about who he says is in his world, I want to hear your reaction to it. What do you think about that? I mean, you and I and others in our circles have spent so much time over the I don't know how many years talking about whether and how the Democratic Party does in fact center Black people who are at its base, and all of those other communities that he name-checked. So, do you think we're in a new place now or no? What is your immediate reaction to hearing him say that?
I mean, new as compared to the Trump administration, yes. I mean, I just imagine how Joe Biden must feel right now. I mean, you know, Joe Biden couldn't make it out of the earliest primary state in 04 or 08. And then he called then-Senator Obama clean and articulate. And, like, it must have looked like it was really kind of all over for Joe Biden's political career. And then, you know, President-elect Obama chooses Joe Biden as his running mate, right? And he gets to go to the White House. So even if he just had that, even if Joe Biden had been rescued from history by Barack Obama and turned into the vice president of the historic first Black president, even that would have been an extraordinary gift of Blackness to Joe Biden. But then that gift kept on giving because, of course, Joe Biden didn't win the Democratic primary. The Democratic primary was won for Joe Biden by members of the Congressional Black Caucus and by African-American Southern voters who turned the tide for Joe Biden, handed that nomination to Joe Biden, and then largely remained quite loyal to Biden over the context of this entire election, even when Biden wasn't always directly campaigning for those votes. And so not that he was, I mean, he wasn't performing like a Clinton era, you know, stiff-armed Black folks, but he also wasn't nurturing those relationships in ways that, frankly, he'd actually been somewhat better at doing even during the Obama years. So I suspect Joe Biden has at least some level of awareness that, like, Black folks did this. You know, Stacey Abrams did this. Kamala Harris did this. Black women voters did this. You know, Barack Obama did this. So I'm all down that Joe Biden seems like a really lovable, decent, good white guy with the right intentions around these issues. I also think he's an American president and a Democratic American president in a very constrained system, and that you know, I have a fairly short wish list for what will come from the presidency over the next 4 years, and a much longer and more aggressive wish list for what will come out of communities and out of state and local politics.
Because you just feel like the presidency is going to be kind of stuck.
So I do think that this is part of the internal anxiety, if we will, of Democrats in this moment is to ask a question about whether or not the most valuable thing that we can do for the American presidency over the course of the next 4 years is to return the office to some level of restraint, or if this is some sort of all-out policy war moment where breaking the rules and continuing to extend executive power is the appropriate response to what the past 4 years have been. And you know, if we go back to your caller who said we're not in a democracy, I'd push back a little bit. I'd say we're in a broken, limping democracy, but we always have been, right? We've always been a democracy that is not quite a full expression of its aspirational possibility. And because I am a Black Southern woman, I have no nostalgia ever about anything, but particularly about any prior moment in the American political story. So, you know, we are certainly a place with some institutions and structures that are not a direct like translation of the popular will, but that's in part because we had founders who were a little nervous about the popular will and about majoritarianism. Right. And look, I'm a Black person, so I have a little bit of anxiety about what majority will just is, right, as well. So I don't think it means we don't live in a democracy. I do think it means we live in a democracy that translates preferences in ways that regularly reproduce the benefits of white supremacy for white folks, and particularly shuts out people of color. And it doesn't mean that every white person benefits from whiteness. And in fact, I would even suggest that much of what's happened in the Trump years is that he has made whiteness much, he's devalued the whiteness dollar. But those like baked in aspects of the system don't mean it's not a democracy. It simply means it's a broken one, and one that we have to continue to push for. And so again, I'll just end on this. The question is, so is the right thing, and I don't know that I have an answer, but is the right thing to throw ourselves into the procedural aspects of democracy, to say that how we get to an outcome, the means, the systems are just as important as the outcome itself? Or do we say, oh, hell no, we may have 48 months to win and we got to win. And so however that win will happen, we're going to take to it. And when I look at Joe Biden, I think he's a little more of a procedural Democrat.
I think he's a little more about the first. And it's interesting that you don't feel like you've got an answer to that. But let's get some more of these callers in. Michelle in Manhattan. Michelle, welcome to WNYC. I understand the last 4 years, you feel like you have had some change.
Yes. First of all, thanks for taking my call. And I guess what's really kind of changed for me is I realized that, you know, having been a regular voter, that I wasn't really that engaged in the entire process. And these past 4 years have really brought to light all of the small and large kind of loopholes, the ways in which the system can be gamed by someone who has no morals or ethics and wants to do it. And we have all kind of run our lives kind of by the honor system, and that's not how people behave. And our expectation of people is they're going to be respectful and they're going to follow process and procedure. And, you know, traditionally what has happened in the past will happen going forward. And Donald Trump completely destroyed that, just willy-nilly, like for the entire 4 years. So it really taught me that I need to be far more aware of the ins and outs of our politics. I need to be more engaged on a local level, because corruption starts local and then filters up. So I just feel like I need to be way more involved and way more aware of my own media consumption, of my own political education, and be more cognizant that not everybody is coming from the same space of respecting one another.
Thank you for that, Michelle. As Melissa said, the camera will make everything grow.
See, I just have to say, though, that that call from Michelle is, I get in trouble whenever I say this, but it is the thing that I love about my President Trump, is that there is a way in which the absolute clarity with which he and his administration sort of laid into relief things that I think had been a matter of contention. And I want to be clear, it's not that they made them clear to all Americans. This is really, for me, about a sort of in-group conversation on the broadest definition of the left, right? So people who understand themselves as non-racist, who understand themselves as Democrats, or who understand themselves as Democrat-leaning, but who regularly engage, especially during the Obama years, in kind of post-racial language or a sense that some level of egalitarian or of equity had been met. And with the election of Donald Trump, I have to say, you know, I did not experience surprise, both because I predicted it, but also because the idea that a racist rapist would become president seemed like a Tuesday afternoon in America. Mm. But this particular racist, with this particular history of, clear claims by reputable individuals that he had sexually assaulted, harassed, and in the case of at least one individual, that he had actually committed forcible rape against her, that his rhetoric, his tone, I mean, at the point at which Charlottesville hosts a white supremacist, a deadly white supremacist rally, and you have Republicans who stand on air and say, I denounce white supremacy. And I thought, man, during the Obama years, you couldn't even say white supremacy existed without a fight on the Democratic side.
Right.
You know, think of how many Confederate statues fell during the Trump presidency. And now I want to be really clear. I don't think that the elevation of Donald Trump is good, because I think too many very real lives were at stake, too many very real children separated from their families, too many very real policies that will impact us for decades. But when I look for the value of this moment, the one thing that I can pull out of it is this sense that it created clarity for so many on the left relative to the continuing problems in our system.
Well, on that note, I want to bring in somebody who I asked to call in because I know she had a journey of this regard. Amara Jones is, who Melissa, you know as well, is the host of the podcast Translash, and as well as a monthly event here at the Green Space. It's called Lives at Stakes. It's meant to be a conversation by and for trans people. And Amara, the name says it all, right? And I wanted to check in with you because I know that this project and a lot of your work over the past year is exactly the kind of thing that Melissa's talking about. It grew out of this moment and it into a whole new kind of movement.
Yeah, well, first of all, hi, Melissa, and hi,
Hey!
Hey, how are you? So, been too long. I think that, you know, everyone had a decision about how they were going to respond to the moment, to the crisis that was born out by 2016. What I decided to do was to take the skills and the knowledge and the understanding that I had as a storyteller, as an analyst, as a journalist, and to take all of those things and to turn them on the community that I am a part of that was being assaulted by this administration. And it comes out of a very simple thing that I think that we've learned even about Donald Trump's trajectory from Celebrity Apprentice to now, which is that who controls the story has control. And so we have to become, as one of your callers said before, I think much more focused on telling the stories of actual people that are demonized in this country so that we don't end up in a place where we have, you know, as we are now, for example, with the highest number of trans women murdered than any other year on record, so that we don't end up with kids in cages, so that we don't end up in this place of dehumanization and borderline fascism. And that's by us being able to see everyone as human. And storytelling plays an essential role in that. And so that's the way that I responded and responded to the moment was by creating Translash, was by creating in every single way that I know how through podcast, through video, through writing, this focus and this need and the urgency around seeing trans people as essential to the story of the country, mm-hmm. as essential to humanity. And I think that even with the victory of Joe Biden, there's still an incredible amount of work that has to be done. But the fact that that was acknowledged shows the importance and the power of us doing that.
The fact that he included the trans community when he was listing off his constituencies. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly right. And the fact that there has been this urgency, and it's not only me, it's lots of different people that we could spend, you know, the rest of the time of the show naming and all of the things that we're naming, but this essential urgency that we're all saying of that you're here, we are essential, that the way that you engage and treat us is a sign of health for this country, is a sign of health for this democracy, is a sign of health for your essential humanity. So what are you doing? And what will you do? And I think that essential moral question that we have put at the center of transness is one that we have forced and will continue to force politicians and so many people from all walks of life to reckon with.
Amar Jones is host of the Translash podcast and our weekly series, Lives at Stake, here at the Green Space at WNYC. And Melissa, I want to right away go to someone else we asked to call in. We've spoken to her as we were covering the voting process in Wisconsin last week. Andrea Kaminsky is an election inspector in the city of Madison and part of the leadership of the League of Women Voters there as well. And Andrea, thanks for calling us in.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
So I just wanted to check in with you and get a sense of what's happening in Wisconsin now. There's the specter of the recount, but does it feel like people there have a sense of resolution with Joe Biden's victory? Do people feel like something has been resolved in that state, which has really been at the center of a lot of these sort of debates that we've been having over the last 4 years? Just what do you pick up on the vibe there?
Well, I live right near the state capitol in Madison, and there have been... there were rallies yesterday. There were going to be kind of dueling rallies, one saying, that we've got the vote and let's protect it and so forth, and the other one saying, we need a recount. And, in terms of democracy, both of those really, those are part of democracy, and they are not an uncommon thing that happens in.
Oh, I think we may have lost you. We'll work on getting Andrea back. In the meantime, let's go to Ben in Manhattan. Ben, welcome to the show.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it. I'd like to go back to the very beginning of the conversation where you started out, which is how, if and in any ways, I was changed in the last 4 years or by
yes,
the election
please.
4 years ago. And in a very substantial way, I was changed. And in other ways, I wasn't changed. It so happens because of my age and I'm retired and I fortunately have financial ability. My day-to-day life did not change. I was fine. However, I think the shock of that election of Mr. Trump coming to the presidency of the United States, as it was incredible, it was also stunning in the sense that I couldn't believe that a man like that in this country could be elected. Mm. He is a first-class con man, and he's not even that good a con man, because if anybody that's really paying attention, you could see in a minute he was a con man. And a good con man, you can't even detect that he's done it. But it really made me think about it. I'm an immigrant. I came here as a child, 4 years old, and everything in this country was always laid out in such a way that I knew if I did A, B, and C, I'd move ahead. If I studied hard, I'd advance in school. I could go to college. I went to an Ivy League school, a good education. I worked through my life in many ways successfully. and you really fit into a structure the way this country was built and the way things ran, and you didn't give that much thought to it, even though we were aware, totally aware, of the way blacks were treated in the South and what went on in the South, and of course what happened in the 1960s. All of that was very aware, but you think of it as, well, I'm going to use the word distant, even though it's not all that distant. But this election, I viewed it, my immediate reaction after the election was two big things. Number one, this was like tearing a scab off a wound. It brought out all of the illnesses that this country had. Racism, the anti-immigrant attitude, the desire to reconstruct this country as a white country, recognizing the fear that so many white people, for some reason, think that they're losing that, that they're losing having a white Christian country. And I think that was an aspect that suddenly sprung into very, very clear. The only way you could account for that many people voting for Mr. Trump, other than, I have to add to that, other than the fact that people were desperate, there were a lot of people hurting.
And Ben, that was, can I ask, so are you saying that was for you a new realization in that moment? You understood that in a way that you hadn't understood it before.
It was a major change in a sense. I came to this country, my family were able to go to work and do whatever we not. The black population, or obviously the majority of the black population in this country, didn't come as free immigrants. They came in shackles. And what happened in this country afterwards was, no matter what they tried to do to become as free as I am, or I was, you know, have been all my life, was to get off those shackles, and at every turn, the shackles were there. Maybe they weren't physical shackles, but they certainly were, and from an operational point of view, how the country ran, they were shackled. And we're paying the price. We're paying a horrendous price for it. And it's a sickness that can't be shaken off. This is not something that you can, it's very, very hard to say to oneself, and I'm saying it
Ben,
to
I'm
myself.
I'm gonna leave it there because we're running out of time and I want to get to a couple more people, but thank you for that. So another person who had a realization in the course of this past 4 years. I want to go back to Andrea Kaminsky in Madison. We've got you back again, Andrea. You were giving us a sense of what it was like there after having been an election inspector, helped run the election there, what people are feeling in Wisconsin now.
Yeah, I think we saw demonstrations or rallies here in the Madison area, right near the Capitol, of Trump supporters and Biden supporters. And the Biden supporters were celebrating. The Trump supporters were saying, "You can't call this election yet." And but we're expecting a recount. We've been so polarized. We've had a couple of recounts in the past several years.
Yeah.
They don't really make much difference.
Right. Does it feel, in about 30 seconds we've got here, does it feel like people are ready to move forward or are still stuck in the debate we were having before Election Day?
I think we'll have some disgruntled people, but I do think that they will move forward. Okay. I think that in the long run, you know, we had a transparent election and people have to accept that. And I think Wisconsinites will.
Thank you for calling in, Andrea. Melissa, last 60 seconds we've got here. So what is, you said earlier, you're excited about what's going to come from the states and the movements. Tick off the things you're excited about.
I'm going to actually do something slightly different because I appreciate so much what Andrea just said about sort of the many sides of democracy. Let me just say this, that when democracy is healthy, when it is functioning and operating the way that we want it to, then democracy is actually for the losers. If you know that you are always going to win, if you are confident that you always have the power to be in control, then you don't really want a democracy. You want some sort of autocratic system. Democracy ensures that even when you lose an election, which you ought to do about half the time in a well-balanced democracy, that you don't lose your rights, that you don't lose your voice, that you don't lose your ability to protest and to make the next argument, to run for office, to be a citizen, to be a resident, to be safe. The whole point of our system is supposed to be that it is safe to lose. Mm. And what I would say is that in the past 4 years, it hasn't been safe to have lost. And that part of what we will have to do to protect our democracy is not only to exercise the power that we now have, but also to ensure that we are doing the thing democracy is meant to do, make it safe to be a loser.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Mirando were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Verilyn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Frohman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. That's right, like the brothers. And as always, I hope that you will join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves. Talk to you soon.